Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:05 a.m. on Tuesday, February 18th, 2020. Present today, we've got Representative Knopp, Representative LeBon, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Johnston, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Foster, and I don't see any legislators in the audience here. We'll begin with the closeout report for the Department of Natural Resources, and I'd like to invite Representative Knopp, staff, Carrie Crocker, and Alexi Painter, legislative finance analyst, to the table. And if you could both put yourself on the record there.
Hi, good morning for the record. Carrie Crocker, staff for Representative Knopp.
And for the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division.
The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Natural Resources submits its recommended operating budget for the fiscal year 2021 to the House Finance Committee. The numbers only budget with amendment recommendations are $65,595,000 of UGF funds, $35,707,200 of DGF funds, $36,265,100 of other funds, $15,964,600 of federal funds, for a total of $153,531,900. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Natural Resources held four meetings with the department analyzing the governor's budget. The subcommittee accepted 13 of the 16 budget action items. Under position recommendations, 620 permanent full-time positions, 247 permanent part-time positions, and 52 temporary positions for a total of 919 positions. The following actions were not accepted by the committee. Transfer from the North Latitude Plant Material Center for the business process efficiencies. Transfer Agricultural Department allocation from agricultural appropriation to fire, land, and water. And transfer to agriculture development for business process efficiencies. The conversation in the committee revolved around the impact of these proposals could have on the agricultural industry, which ultimately resulted in these items not being accepted by the committee. The following amendments were submitted by the Department of Natural Resources House Finance Subcommittee for consideration. $5 million, this amendment of unrestricted general funds. This amendment creates a new transaction to fund fire risk reduction and create fire risk reduction projects, including but not limited to fire breaks as well as maintenance of other existing fire risk reduction projects. Amendment two is $210,000 of designated general funds. It's from the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund, and this amendment adds one natural resource specialist permanent full-time position. Both amendments were adopted by the House Finance Budget Subcommittee for Natural Resources. The attached reports are the wordage report, the operation budget transaction comparison between 2021 governor and the House subcommittee, the operation budget transaction compare between the 2021 adjusted base and the House subcommittee, and the multi-year agency totals.
Okay, great, thank you. Are there any questions, Representative LeBon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the position Natural Resource Specialist 3, did the agency provide detail about the why for adding that position or the function for that position or what was missing in the department prior to adding that position? Did they provide detail regarding that request?
Through the chair, I think Mr. Painter would be better equipped to answer that question.
Mr. Painter, if you could put yourself on the record.
Sure. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. Through the chair, Representative LeBon, this was an addition from the subcommittee, not a department recommendation. The governor last year vetoed the funding for two positions in this allocation for this purpose of servicing the loans and providing new loans. So this position would essentially replace one of those two positions from last year.
Thank you.
Representative Knopf.
Just elaborate a little bit more. So it was my understanding that what was happening, we had two people servicing existing loans, about $8 million in that fund that was not being utilized. Nobody there to originate the loans and process it. So that's what this position is to do, is to get that loan program active again. So.
Okay. Representative Sullivan Leonard, then Walden Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is with regard to the fire suppression piece here. Can you remind me what we have through the chair, what we have in the supplemental budget for fire suppression funding, and then kind of what the discussion was with this additional $5 million added to that?
Representative Sullivan Leonard through the chair. So the supplemental was for fire suppression activity. This amendment added funding to, so it, the supplemental is for $110 million for fire suppression activity. This adds funding to fire suppression preparedness, which is sort of upfront costs and purchases and that sort of thing. And actually, not mentioned in the narrative, but it also was paid for by a reduction of $5 million to fire suppression activity. So this amendment is... That amendment decreased fire suppression activity by $5 million and increased fire suppression preparedness by $5 million.
All right, thank you for that clarification.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the position out of the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund, and it says it's a permanent position, so is that gonna, does the funding come out of the fund and that's just gonna keep drawing down the fund? Also, $210,000 for Range 18, is that, is there monies above and beyond the costs of hiring and employing that one position at to the, in other words, 210,000 Range 18 seems a little out of balance.
Representative Wolf through the chair, to first question, the interest rates on the loans would pay for the position. So previously, the loans program was roughly self-sustaining. I think it lost money when we had the McKinley Meat and Sausage Plant that was a net loser, but with the loans themselves, they've been, they've more than made up the cost of administering them. And the costs here includes both the cost of that position and services costs to pay the administrative services division for doing the technical work of servicing the loans. Currently, they're doing that without funding directly from the loan to pay for, the loan program to pay for that.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may be mistaken, but wasn't it within this budget cycle that there was a transfer positions for the purposes of increasing personnel to permit mariculture projects within the DNR budget? Am I incorrect on that?
Representative Ortiz through the chair, yes, that was a governor's item, was funding two positions that have actually already been transferred but not yet filled to assist with permitting mariculture projects.
So they were transferred last year, but they just weren't filled?
Representative Ortiz, they were transferred, I think, very recently within the last few months, and they're, my understanding is they're currently recruiting, but I may have my timeline a little off.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And so, let's see, next up, I believe, is Kelly Cunningham, Legislative Fiscal Analyst, as well as Mr. Crocker for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Kelly.
Ms. Cunningham, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, Kelly Cunningham, Legislative Finance.
For the record, Kerry Crocker. Staff to Representative Knopf. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development submits its recommended operating budget for fiscal year 2021 to the House Finance Subcommittee. The numbers only budget recommendation totals are
$18,730,400 unrestricted general funds, $38,143,500 of DGF funds, $17,390,700 of other funds, $76,395,700 of federal funds, for a total of $150,660,300. Under position, the recommendations are 633 full-time positions, 48 permanent part-time positions, and 22 temporary positions, for a total of 733 positions. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development held four meetings with the department analyzing the governor's budget. The subcommittee accepted 14 of the 15 budget action items proposed. This includes the following: replaced $1.4 million of UGF with the $1.4 million of general fund program receipts to correct categorization of certified payroll filing fees. Alaska Vocational Technical Center deletes positions no longer needed after the restructure, which is a decrement of $226,700 UGF dollars. Closed the Kodiak Field Office, eliminates two positions, it's a decrement of $84,300 UGF dollars. Alaska Vocational Technical Center added additional authority for contract training in response to industry for $234,100 of DGF. Budget actions not accepted were a decrement of $124,400 of general funds for labor standards and safety, wage and hour administration. Another subcommittee action, the House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development recommends the committee include the following language. It is the intent of the legislature that the department maintains fiscal year 2019 levels to sustain or expand investigative capacity in the wage and hour and administration in the Fairbanks office. The other attached reports are the wordage report, the operating budget transaction comparison between the 2021 governor and the House subcommittee, the operating budget transaction compare between 2021 and adjusted base in the House subcommittee, and the multi-year agency totals.
Any questions on labor? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the category of your budget items that you accepted, closing the field office and eliminate two positions, first of all, the amount of savings was only $84,300, is that correct? And then second of all, did you hear from the department about the impact of closing the Kodiak field office?
Yeah, through the chair, Rep. Ortiz, the number 84,000 is correct. Those positions weren't filled, and currently is what we heard from the department. And so little to no impact was the general consensus.
Follow up.
So there remains some staff people there. These are just two positions that weren't filled, but there continues to be a presence from the Department of Labor there?
Rep. Ortiz, through the chair, I don't believe there's any staff there currently. They're just closing the office.
Thank you.
Representative Wool and then Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the committee rejected the decrement of 124,000 that the department recommended or wanted, and then also the committee wanted intent language to sustain or expand wage and hour in Fairbanks. Can I conclude that the reduction of 124,000 was that for a Fairbanks position?
To the chair, Representative Wool. That's correct. It's the intent of the committee to add a investigator position in Fairbanks.
Follow-up.
Okay. So was the reduction the department wanted? Was that position? Did they want to eliminate that position, or is that just money?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, the department wanted to eliminate an office assistant position. And the committee would like to maintain the current personnel levels
okay.
in that position in Fairbanks.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Carpenter?
That was my question.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Knopp?
Not a question, Mr. Chairman. But I would ask that we could bring the admin service director to the table. I want to speak to the earlier question, not the one so much in Fairbanks, but the concern was, Mr. Crocker is correct, there was a admin position scheduled to go away. There was concern from a committee member that all the work going on in Fairbanks in the oversight and the wage and hour labor division he wanted to. So the governor's request was to get rid of that position for $124,000. We rejected that and opted to put a member in Fairbanks office for the oversight because all the work going on up in that area. That was the purpose of that request. And if I get the admin service director to come forward, Mr. Chairman, speak to the Kodiak office, what was going on over there. What I recall the department saying, there was just no purpose for that office there. They had no business. And so I just ask her to elaborate on that.
And if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Hannah Lager. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Through the Chair, Representative Knopp's clarification, I really appreciate. In the Kodiak office for vocational rehabilitation, we had two positions. One of them was filled. That office was closed effective December 31st, so any clients there will receive service remotely from our Anchorage office. In Kodiak, we do still have a job center presence, so we do still have Department of Labor employees there.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thanks, Ms. Lager. And so with that, thank you, Ms. Cunningham and Mr. Crocker. We will next move over to the legislature's budget. And I'd like to invite up my staff, Ryan Johnston, as well as Ms. Cunningham. And if you could put yourself on the record there, Mr. Johnston.
For the record, Ryan Johnston, staff representative Neil Foster. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the legislature, we recommend the acceptance of the governor's proposed budget with two amendments, the addition of $100,000 in UGF to the legislative budget and audit personal services line to assist with the statewide audits, and then intent language passed by legislative council directing the legislature not to appropriate funds to compensate the Office of Management and Budget for accounting services. So with those two amendments, the total budget comes to $64,677,000 of unrestricted general funds, $327,000 of designated general funds, and $1,087,000 of other funds with zero federal funds for a total of $66,672,000. The unrestricted general fund difference for FY21's adjusted base to the House subcommittee budget recommendation is an increase of $100,000 UGF, which is a 0.02% increase from the FY21 adjusted base.
Any questions for legislature? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Could you clarify a bit with the intent language stating that the legislature will not provide funding for Office of Management and Budget? What is that entail?
Through the chair, recently the Office of Management and Budget has started directing departments to pay for the accounting services provided by OMB and budget analysis while creating budgets. So this is a new thing that the legislature has not done in the past, and when it was directed upon them, legislative council voted and with unanimous consent, I believe, stated that the legislature will not be doing that and will not be partaking in that practice.
Further, Representative LeBon and then Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going up to under budget action, adding 100,000 UGF to the legislative audit and budget personnel services, offsetting the vacancy factor, did you lower the vacancy factor to fund that money, those funds?
Through the chair, Chris Curtis, the legislative budget auditor, is here, and I think she'd probably be the best to speak to that, Representative LeBon.
Ms. Curtis, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, your state legislative auditor. This $100,000 is to help reduce our vacancy factor. So even after the addition of $100,000, we'll have a vacancy factor of about 8.8%. And that's to help provide additional resources to deal with the workload and help issue the opinions on a timely basis. This increment was actually included in our governor's budget, and the Office of Management and Budget took it out, which was similar to what they did with the court system, which I want to, on record, I find extremely troubling. That type of action can be considered retaliatory in regards to like a qualified opinion. So the governor's office removed $100,000 from our governor's budget.
Follow up. So just to make sure I'm understanding this, the phrase offset the vacancy factor, it means the proposed vacancy factor was too high or too low?
Through the chair, it should say reduce the vacancy factor.
Thank you.
And we've got Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to understand that position, it's legislative audit and budget. Is that your department?
Yes, through the chair, that's okay. Legislative audit.
Okay. Not to be confused, legislative budget and audit, LB&A, which is a committee.
Yes, through the chair, legislative audit reports to the LB&A committee. And is the LB&A committee actually has its own separate budget to preserve that independence.
Follow up.
So can I conclude that the increase in the budget to the legislature of 0.02%, I think Mr. Johnson said, is that pretty much the $100,000?
That, through the chair, that is correct, Representative Wolf.
Thank you.
Any further questions on the legislature? Seeing no questions, thank you, Ms. Curtis, Mr. Johnson, and Ms. Cunningham. Are you still here for corrections? Looks like you are. Thank you. So next we'll have Department of Corrections and Mr. Representative Woolstaff, and we've got with us Ashley, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, Ashley Carrick, staff to Representative Wool. The Department of Corrections Finance Subcommittee presents the following numbers for House Finance. In unrestricted general funds, $327.1 million. Designated general funds, $13.9 million. Other funds is $25.9 million. And federal funds is $13.2 million, for a total in the Department of Corrections of $380.2 million. The difference in unrestricted general fund from FY20 base to the House Finance Subcommittee's budget recommendation is a $27.4 million decrement, and that's a 9.2% below the FY20 adjusted base. The department currently has 2,021 permanent full-time positions with zero part-time and zero temporary positions. The subcommittee held 5 meetings and considered 36 governor's budget action items as well as 6 subcommittee amendments. Some of the highlights from the DOC subcommittee include the following. We restored funding to reopen the Palmer Correctional Center for 16.6 million UGF and added intent language for the department to open the Palmer Correctional Center by January 1, 2021. We also created and consolidated the recruitment and retention program and allocation, adding 163.2 UGF and 3 new positions and consolidating 286.8 million UGF from existing allocations. We denied the request to add authority for positions and copy machines for photocopying incoming inmate mail. That led to a decrement of 415.7 million UGF. We added authority for an additional drug dog to combat contraband. This is an increment of 253.2 million UGF. And we denied the governor's proposal to send prisoners to private prisons out of state. That's a decrement of 17.8 million UGF. And we also added positions and authority to establish a new reentry unit under Health and Rehabilitation Services for 746.1 thousand UGF and 3 new positions. At this time, the subcommittee would like to recommend the House Finance Committee take the following 2 actions. We would The subcommittee appropriated funding to the Palmer Correctional Center with the expectation that the Finance Committee will move these funds into a language appropriation to ensure that they're used for the specific purpose of reopening the Palmer facility in FY21. If the Finance Committee fails to move these funds to a language appropriation, we would request that the Palmer Correctional Center allocation be moved out of population management and established as its own appropriation to prevent the transfer of funds outside of the allocation. And the second recommendation is we denied the second year funding for House Bill 49 fiscal notes under the Institution Director's Office in Physical Health Care with the expectation that revised costs are forthcoming.
And do we have any questions for corrections? Representative Josephson?
Thank you, through the chair. How is it that with the passage of House Bill 49, the budget was reduced from FY20?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, the numbers that we received from the governor's budget this year were not correct. They needed to be updated. They were projections from HB 49's passage. So rather than pass these funding allocations and then have to come back and revise them, it was the recommendation from Ledge Finance that we not accept them and then accept accurate numbers in full Finance Committee.
Follow up.
Your budget action item, the first one, you say restore funding to reopen Palmer Correctional Center. Is it possible that a different word might work better? I mean, I'm not asking to change this. I'm saying that it's a continued request to restore funding. Is that right?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Johnston?
Yes, I just for the record, I think there were two changes that you might have misplaced the zeros on.
The chair, I noticed that as well as I was reading it. Those two were the first two items on the second page of this closeout narrative, and I'll just read those again for the record if that would be helpful. The first was creating and consolidating a recruitment and retention program allocation for 163.2,000 UGF and three new positions, and consolidating 286.8,000 UGF from existing allocations. And the second one to correct for the record was we've denied a request to add authority for positions and copy machines for incoming inmate mail. That's a decrement of 415.7,000 UGF. I misspoke on both of those.
Representative Sylvan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question with regard to what was just stated with regard to recalculating the governor's budget that was proposed. How do you know that his budget was incorrect, and can we have some clarification on that and on what was changed or updated so I can see it a little bit more clearly? I mean, it's a pretty bold statement to say that you've revised the governor's budget because it was inaccurate or wasn't correct. So,
Ms. Cunningham?
Through the chair, Representative Colleen Sullivan Leonard. My understanding is the department has been communicating with Representative Wool's office and Ledge Finance because amendments will be coming tomorrow, and it will just give the legislature a clearer picture if the committee waits for those amendments. They have acknowledged they need to modify the institution director's office numbers as well as the healthcare numbers because of the changes from HB 49 and this new fiscal year. So we are not, it is not an accusatory statement. I believe it is the department has stated they will be submitting amendments for this.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
If I could. Thank you, Kelly, and I appreciate that. And so what we have then is $404,739,000 that the governor has proposed, and then that would be amended then for what you've just stated, amendments are coming?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I'm not on the 404 million. I was focused on the $24 million difference from the governor's budget, and that is primarily comprised of the institution director's office item plus the healthcare item. That is the major difference in the number. So it's not really a $24 million reduction to the Department of Corrections. Mm-hmm. It is simply increments that were not accepted at this point because we're waiting for amendments.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes, Mr. Any further questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you very much. And so that takes us over to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Developments, and Representative Woolstaff, Stephanie Andrew, as well as Alexi Painter.
I know.
But you were the chair.
I don't have any questions. I do. I'm gonna ask them later.
Good morning. For the record, Stephanie Andrew, staff to Representative Wool. The House Finance Subcommittee for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development submits the following budget report to the House Finance Committee for consideration. An overall budget of $132,535,100, comprised of $8,462,900 in unrestricted general funds, $54,572,100 in designated general funds, $48,476,600 in other funds, and $21,023,500 in federal funds. The difference between the FY21 adjusted base and the subcommittee recommendation is a reduction of $103,200, or 1.2%. The use of unrestricted general funds is down 72.5% since FY15 management plan. The subcommittee adopted 17 of the 18 budget action items proposed by the governor. The subcommittee rejected a decrement of $546,600 in UGF from the Economic Development Division. The subcommittee adopted two amendments, one to include intent language relating to ADA and utilizing a competitive bid process, and a second amendment to decrement ADA receipt authority by $110,300. And with that, I conclude the report on the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development House Finance Subcommittee.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee? I don't see any questions. Thank you very much, Ms. Andrew. And so with that, takes us over to the Department of Law, and I'd like to invite Representative Josephson staff, Catherine Reardon, as well as Michael Partlow, Legislative Fiscal Analyst, up to the table, if you could both put yourselves on the record.
For the record, Michael Partlow, Legislative Finance.
For the record, I'm Catherine Reardon, aide to Representative Andy Josephson. Mr. Chair, the House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Law submitted the following recommended operating budget for FY21 to the House Finance Committee. A total operating budget for FY21 of $88,941,800, consisting of $51,720,600 of unrestricted general funds, $2,691,000 of designated general funds, $32,504,000 of other funds, and $2,026,200 of federal funds. The budget recommended by the subcommittee is $755,000 lower in UGF funding than the governor's requested budget for FY21. It is $847,700 higher in UGF funding than the FY21 adjusted base. This increase from adjusted base is due to a fund source change from power cost equalization funds to UGF for costs associated with anti-crime legislation that passed last session. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee began by accepting the governor's proposed changes to the FY21 adjusted base, which include, in addition to the fund source change I just mentioned, $300,000 of statutory designated program receipts
and two positions added to utilize funding from the North Slope Borough to increase staffing in the district attorney's office in Utqiagvik. They also accepted a $500,000 increment in federal receipts and three positions, which will be utilized with grant money from the U.S. Department of Justice for staff to focus on felony crimes in rural Alaska. And the subcommittee accepted a decrement of $224,800 in AOGCC receipts because those funds are no longer needed. The subcommittee spent a great deal of time focusing in detail on the two areas that were subjects of intent language in the FY20 budget. And those topics were recruitment and retention difficulties in the department, particularly in the criminal division, but also in the civil division, and the issue of outside counsel and associated costs. The recruitment and retention discussion include reviewing a report from the department that was submitted in response to this year's intent language, which showed that higher levels of turnover and vacancy problems continue, with especially critical in the criminal division and rural areas of the state, and that this problem relates to both paralegals and support staff as well as attorneys. But the department was clear that no action from the legislature through the budget is required at this time or desired at this time to address the problem. That raised the issue of whether there is excess personal services funding in the department, which is a concern because it can be spent elsewhere as personal services can be moved to other line items. The subcommittee therefore adopted intent language directing that personal services funding should be spent on personal services and that if it is not needed there should be lapsed rather than used in other areas as a goal for FY21. The subcommittee also recommended deleting three positions and funding from the special litigation allocation of the civil division. The another major issue of focus was the issue of outside counsel. The FY20 budget included intent language directing the department to minimize the use of outside counsel. So the subcommittee looked closely at contracts that have been entered into for outside counsel in the current fiscal year, and specifically looked at 11 contracts and $300,000 that have been spent by the labor and state affairs allocation in the last 6 months, and a new contract for $600,000 that has been entered into by that section of the criminal division. They reviewed the terms of the contracts and asked about prioritization and negotiation of rates, and in the end decided to reduce the labor and state affairs allocation by $400,000 in the services line. Finally, testimony from the department indicated that despite a reduction in funding, it was likely that funds would be transferred to continue to fund some of those high-dollar contracts. And as a result, the subcommittee decided to create a separate appropriation, segregating off money to be used or available for use for contracts for outside counsel related to the Janus decision, and funded that new appropriation with $20,000 and renamed the existing civil division appropriation to make it clear that funding is not to be used from that appropriation for the $600,000 contract. And that was the recommendation from the subcommittee. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to understand this outside contract funding, the subcommittee suggested that that these monies are separate and isolated, so it can't be used for the Janus decision. I mean, it limits all their outside contracting money, legal money, or is it just for that one particular case?
Through the chair, the separate appropriation is just for that particular case. It also should be clarified that this is a limit in expenditure on outside counsel. The department retains its ability to use its own attorneys, as many as they wish, as many internal resources as they wish to pursue whatever case they wish.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if another case were to arise that the department thought they might need outside counsel, are they still under that limit of the same pool of money, or could they find monies elsewhere, say for Citizens United or another high profile case?
Through the chair, representative, the separate appropriation only relates to a limitation on contracting for interpretation of the Janus Supreme Court decision. So any other outside counsel can continue to be contracted and spent from the civil division appropriation.
Thank you. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to kind of get my head wrapped around the rationale on all this. So you're reducing staff within the civil division, and then you're reducing the ability for that particular division to seek assistance from outside counsel as needed. How does that work? I mean, you're reducing staff, which doesn't actually make sense when you're saying we're not going to go for outside counsel to assist us on particular issues that come before the state, and then we're also going to reduce your staff. So you're reducing staff, and then you're reducing the ability to seek outside counsel if it is so needed. So can you give me the rationale on that?
through the chair, representative, the first information that the subcommittee had to consider is that the civil division underspent its personal services budget by over $3 million in the last complete fiscal year, which was FY19, which closed, of course, 6 months ago. That money was not all UGF, but given that, the reduction to the special litigation allocation and the reduction in positions there related to the impression that possibly there was more funds available for other uses in the department than were necessary, not as an attempt to reduce the department's ability to engage in civil activities, not to trigger layoffs in reduction in personal services resources, human resources. The decision to limit the contract expenditure on Janus followed the $100,000 expenditure for that work that already occurred last fall. And the feeling was that in tight economic times, $100,000 and another 20 was sufficient.
Okay, it's still not quite clear, but thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Just to emphasize a couple things the subcommittee found. It found that what I've come to learn is that a typical vacancy rate or a one that is prudent is generally in the 4% range. The Department of Laws is 12%, and we asked the Chief of Staff in two successive hearings if that number seemed accurate, and he didn't suggest that it wasn't. So they have the revenue, and they've used it, and we tracked it very carefully in two sections, in part to fund a very, very, very expensive contract. They obtained a reduced rate from $950 an hour for a Washington law firm to $600 an hour, which was great. It remains very expensive. So we don't believe, given the continuing large vacancy rate, that there will be any termination of attorneys. As an attorney, I would be predisposed to appreciate their work, and I'm not trying to, pink slip anyone, and we don't think that's going to happen. Thank you.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we going down a slippery slope here in managing the decision-making process in the Department of Law by choking off funding for an issue maybe through appropriation we might not agree with as a subcommittee level? Is the opposite a possibility where the subcommittee might encourage funding for outside counsel on an issue that they agreed with and expect the department to take that type of action? In other words, this is a two-way street. Did that come up during the discussion at the subcommittee level?
Through the chair, Representative, I believe that the subcommittee discussed the issues in detail and with some complexity. It should be noted, I believe. Well, I'll stop there.
Representative Josephson.
I think Representative LeBon makes a good point that we're not supposed to micromanage the prerogative of the administration to do largely what it wishes to do, albeit we are the appropriators. What the subcommittee really concluded was that in very tight fiscal times, this sort of contract was not fiscally responsible, especially given that no other state in the union had made the legal arguments being made here. And then a final point is that the administration is free to use its own AAGs, assistant attorneys general, to litigate this thing to the nth degree if it wishes. Thank you.
Representative Merrick. Representative Carpenter and then Merrick.
Oh, it's okay. She can go first. Okay.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Foster. The reduced rate of $600 per hour, how does that compare to a price per hour for inside counsel or in-house counsel?
Through the chair, Representative, I believe that the Department of Law charges $169 an hour to departments for services.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter and then Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I think I just heard is that we do have a conflict of opinion between members of the legislature and the executive on how to apply the Janus decision, and we are decrementing funds to further our opinion. I think that's what I just heard. If we disagree with how the executive is dealing with this situation, there are other means to deal with this in the legal arena, but reducing funding to make it more difficult for them to do their job is not appropriate. And we had just heard from another department where the governor's office was supposedly doing that to the legislature, and we got indignant about it. And now we're going to do the exact same thing to the governor's office. And I see this as hypocrisy.
Representative Ortiz.
I'll just add that I, in the name of fiscal responsibility, it seems reasonable that if the state in any way is contracting out for $900 an hour, an action on the part of the subcommittee to restrain the ability to do so, I think, is a good thing in the name of fiscal responsibility, which I think we're all on board with in this committee of being fiscally responsible.
And we will certainly be, I would guess, come back to this issue. There may be some amendments on it, and so certainly this is not the end of this. And if there are amendments, then you know we'll have that debate again. With that, are there any further questions or comments? And we expect, by the way, to be taking up amendments next week in finance. So with that, any further questions on law? Seeing none, thank you very much. And with that, and the next subcommittee will be judiciary. So looks like Ms. Reardon and Mr. Painter Thank you, Mr. Partlow.
Mr. Chair, this is Catherine Reardon, aide to Representative Andy Josephson. The Budget Subcommittee for the Judicial Branch of Government recommends that the operating budget requested by the Alaska court system for FY21 be approved in full. The recommended budget totals $114,406,500. This total consists of $110,706,500 of unrestricted general funds, $518,000 of designated general funds, $2,206,100 of other funds. The court system budget includes 755 positions, of which 733 are full-time, 37 are part-time, and 5 are temporary. The subcommittee recommendation is $2,902,100 above FY21 adjusted base in UGF funding and $334,700 UGF above the budget submitted by the governor. Over $1 million of the UGF increase is due to a fund source change from power cost equalization endowment funds to UGF for costs associated with anti-crime legislation passed last session. The judicial branch has 3 separate appropriations. The main appropriation is the court system and much smaller ones for therapeutic courts, the Commission on Judicial Conduct, and the Judicial Council are the other 3 appropriations. The court system requested 9 changes from its adjusted base budget, which can be grouped into increments to address the backlog in criminal appeals, increments to maintain and strengthen the therapeutic court system, and increments for overhead and operational costs, such as facility maintenance and leases, payments to the executive branch for risk management and archiving, and the services provided by OMB. The last item is similar to the topic that was discussed in the legislative branch discussion. The subcommittee found that the judicial branch's budget request was reasonable and recommends its adoption.
Any questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, thank you very much. Ms. Reardon, Mr. Painter, are there any questions before we adjourn? I don't see any questions or comments. So with
Thank
that,
Chairman, we could.
Correct. We will be adjourning and then reconvening at 1:30 today.
Would you clarify amendment deadline date for us, please?
We don't have that at this time. So what for the rest of the week, we're looking at Wednesday, Thursday, Friday will be public testimony from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. And then on Saturday, public testimony from 12 to 3. And we have yet to set the amendment deadline, but it will be most likely Saturday, late Saturday. And but we'll let you know on that. And then our expectation would be to take up amendments next week. So any further questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an agenda here that has the university. Can I assume we're doing that in this afternoon session?
Correct. I'm thinking tomorrow morning possibly. Okay. So the university subcommittee will be closing out, I believe, at 5 p.m. today.
Oh, right.
So we will reconvene in the morning, close out the last subcommittee report, and then once that's done, then all the subcommittee reports can be wrapped up into the first version of the committee substitute, and that'll be read on Wednesday, tomorrow afternoon. I believe that's correct. That is correct. So with that, any further questions? Seeing no further questions, our next meeting is scheduled for today at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting, we will have a presentation on the long-term forecast of Medicaid enrollment and spending in Alaska by Evergreen Economics. So with that, we'll be adjourned at 9:59 a.m. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 p.m. on Tuesday, February 18th, 2020. Present today, we've got Representative Knopp, Representative Laban, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Johnston, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl, Representative Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, if you could please mute your cell phones. And this afternoon, the committee will hear a presentation from Evergreen Economics on Alaska's long-term Medicaid forecast. And I'd like to invite Ted Holvoit, Vice President of Evergreen Economics, up to the table. And thank you for joining us. And if you could, Commissioner Crum, we also have him coming up. I think he has to step out for a cabinet meeting relatively soon, but if you could both put yourselves on the record, and I'd open up to you, Commissioner, to make some opening remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. I'm here to do an introduction of Dr. Ted Holvoit. So I do appreciate the committee taking the time to look at this, because this is a very dense subject, and a lot of what we do with the Medicaid is very immediate and you worry about now, but we have to take the time to look up into the future of what these numbers mean. And I appreciate your insight as you go through this presentation. It's very insightful. So Dr. Ted Holvoit is Vice President of Evergreen Economics, a consulting and research firm headquartered in Portland, Oregon. He is a former member of the faculty at the Lundquist College of Business at the University of Oregon, where he taught applied regression analysis and other statistical methods. He has more than 20 years of professional experience conducting economic and statistical analysis for clients in the healthcare, energy, and natural resource sectors. Evergreen Economics has been under contract with the department since 2011, when Dr. Holvoit co-founded Evergreen Economics. Prior to that, the department contracted for his services through Econ Northwest. Dr. Holvoit prepares the Medicaid Enrollment and Spending in Alaska report, also known as the MESA, which is a 20-year forecast that is updated each year. The forecast is developed based on more than 20 years of enrollment and claim level data from DHSS. Dr. Holvoit was the lead author of the first long-term Alaska Medicaid forecast conducted by the Lewin Group in 2005 and presented to the legislature in 2006. Since then, the department has engaged to conduct annual updates of the long-term Medicaid forecast and to develop short-term forecasts that assist the Department of Health and Social Services with fiscal year planning and budgeting. He also provides training and support to the Medicaid Budget Group and has also conducted numerous other analyses for the department, including the cost of 8 chronic conditions to the Alaska Medicaid program, potential savings to the Alaska Medicaid program from diabetes self-management, forecast of enrollment and spending on Medicaid expansion, trends in Alaska's senior population, and enrollment in programs and spending on services for Alaskan seniors. So again, thank you to the committee for engaging in this concept. You know, as we look towards the future at Alaska's long-term budget issues, this is something we're all going to have to discuss together on how we can address. So I'm very appreciative of that and hope you enjoy the presentation.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thanks, Adam.
And if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes. For the record, my name is Ted Holvoit, Vice President of Evergreen Economics. So, and thank you for having me here.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Anybody here in the legislature in 2005, 2006?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Was anyone in the legislature in 2005, 2006 for that?
I think
all new audience. That's great. Okay. So this forecast is, as Adam mentioned, is an update of that original forecast that the legislature asked to be done. They set aside the money, had DHSS issue an RFP, which was won by the Lewin Group. And so I was the lead author of that original study. And so it's been quite a pleasure of mine to continue with this work since then. So let's get going. So there's going to be some natural breaks in here that's great places to ask questions as I go through here. But if there's something that's not clear that I say, please stop me and ask a question. So some background. As mentioned, 2005, it's a 20-year forecast. It assumes throughout, the forecast always assumes that Medicaid as it exists today is going to exist in the future. And so in that early forecast, we had no idea that there's going to be the ACA, that there's going to be Medicaid expansion. We're not predicting recessions. We're not predicting any change in policy. We're not even predicting
some change in FMAP rates. So it assumes the program exists today. And that's the importance of that is that for the department leadership and for the legislature to understand what spending is going to look like, what enrollment is going to look like 20 years from now, given the program that you have today. And understanding that there's going to be things that are going to change that are that Alaska cannot control, that may come from the federal government, as well as from population change and such. But then there's the aspects of it that Alaska can't control, that the department can't control with respect to services offered, eligibility requirements, and such. And so it provides a benchmark against the future. So we guess where things are going to be going as of today, and then we see where things actually go, as well as be able to make adjustments to where we want it to go. So the idea is not that this forecast comes true, that in fact that something happens, that the legislature and the department make the changes they need to make sure that those spending projections don't come true in many cases. In addition, there's the forecast. It's a very bottoms-up forecast, and so it very much focuses on population demographics. So that's integral into the forecast, as well as rates of enrollment for different groups, for men and for women, for children, for the elderly, for working age, and for regions of the state as well. As well as looking at utilization and intensity of Medicaid services, and then finally, increases in prices of medical services. We're going to skip over this one, but it's in there just so for your own reference to know what these terms mean. We might come back to those if there's some questions. Modeling approach. So we start with population. This is the state's own population that is developed by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development every couple years. And we slice it, dice it, and reform it so that it meets the regions that we care about and the demographic subcomponents that we look at. From there, we deal with we're looking at enrollment. So for all of these different groups, for different age groups and genders and such, and then the utilization services. So the Medicaid offers a lot of different services, and since that original forecast and through today, we divide those services, many services, or we segment those services into 20 different categories. And so when we talk about utilization of services with respect to this forecast, it's the individual service categories that individual touches, and that's changed over time. And the earliest years of data we have is from 1997, and on average, the typical Medicaid enrollee utilized fewer than three of those services, like 2.7 services. Today, it's closer to 3.5, 3.6. So they're touching more services now. In addition, intensity of Medicaid use is they're using more of an individual service. That's grown over time. And then finally, the elephant in the room constantly is price inflation, and so that final component is to add that in there to come up with a spending forecast. So let's look at some historical trends. So the first one, going from 2012 to today, through fiscal year 2019, Medicaid enrollment has grown by 51%, and recipients, the number or the percent change in recipients has grown slightly slower. The difference between these two is a recipient is a Medicaid enrollee who receives services. A Medicaid enrollee is just anyone who's enrolled in Medicaid. Federal spending grew very rapidly, almost doubled over that period of time, grew by 93%, while GF spending increased by less than 6%. And that's not 6% per year, that's 6% spending growth over that entire period.
So, I had a question, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, if I could, please. So when we look at the Medicaid enrollment in the sense that it grew by 51% within this time period, do you have the data to show why it increased? And I guess I'm just curious as to what the other options were for recipients before that increase in Medicaid.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, we had a similar question earlier today with the Senate, and we're going to look at it. It was more precise of how much of this was expansion, how much of it was the economy, how much of it was the woodwork effect associated with ACA. And so we know who was on Medicaid for expansion, but we don't know that person enrolled in Medicaid through expansion because they met the qualifications because they're single and they're not disabled and they just lost their job. So was it economic related, as opposed to simply they would have been eligible had it existed earlier. So we can't be certain why a person went on to Medicaid, but we do know did they come in through an eligibility that was what their eligibility category was. Was it through a disability? Was it because of expansion? Was it for another reason? And so we can make some estimates of how much of this increase is due to expansion, directly expansion, so we're not eligible at all before expansion, versus other aspects of ACA, so no wrong door, as well as the income or the insurance requirements. And so there are a lot of traditional, more people that are, with respect to traditional Medicaid that came on, that just didn't bother to enroll before, but when they were mandated to have insurance, they then enrolled. Or they signed up for TANF or something, and they ended up on Medicaid also. So the why someone enrolled, we wouldn't know. But we do know what their eligibility category that they came in on, and we can make, based on statistical analysis, make some estimates of what impact the recession that Alaska's experienced, how that's influenced it.
Okay, just quick follow-up, Mr. Hello? Chairman. So I guess what I'm hearing is that partially because of the failure of the Affordable Care Act, then recipients that would normally be going towards a private healthcare company of sorts are more or less forced then to go to Medicaid for some type of health care coverage.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, not exactly. So in many cases, I assume that the individuals who did not have access to insurance through a private marketplace, there certainly would be when if we're talking about expansion, there would be two sets of individuals. Those that were uninsured before became eligible through expansion and enrolled in Medicaid, as well as those that were covered through private insurance before expansion, became eligible, dropped that insurance coverage through their employer, or that they had purchased privately on their own and went into Medicaid. We don't know. It's that's not captured in the at enrollment for that. But that's certainly either one of those is a possibility. So, mm-hmm.
Representative Knoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I need you to go back to Medicaid 101.
All right.
First, when did we adopt the Medicaid expansion in Alaska? 17, 16? 16?
16, yeah.
2016? Yes. So tell me exactly. We've always had Medicare. What did the expansion do? Is it eligibility, services? What did the expansion actually do?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Knopp. So expansion started September 1st, 2015. So fiscal year 2016. So the third month of fiscal year 2016. Medicaid expansion expanded Medicaid eligibility to adults who are not disabled and did not have dependent children. They did not have, were not cared for, and did not have dependents that they provide care for. All three of those are important, those criteria. So you could have been an adult with dependent children, and you may have been eligible for Medicaid before that. You may have been an adult, working age adult, who was disabled and could have been eligible for Medicaid. So the expansion opened Medicaid up to working age adults who are not disabled and did not have dependents, so children, and that's for ages essentially 19 to 64. That would be the expansion population.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So if you just look at the chart and you look at how the enrollment numbers jump in that time frame, you know, you could almost assume that everybody jumped on Medicaid because of eligibility. But it's hard for me to imagine that we just had that many adults in that range that jumped on just because, well, maybe because now they were eligible. So I guess what I'm wondering, Medicaid is eligibility is also based on assets, incomes, dependents. Would that be fair to say? Is that making eligibility for?
Yeah, through the chair, relooking at all of the criteria, but yes, income certainly is main criteria. So it is certainly a health care insurance for the poor.
So I guess the last final question, Mr. Chair. So did them ranges of eligibility change with the expansion?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp. The all the other traditional eligibilities did not change. So what changed was the addition of one new eligibility group.
Okay.
And that but what did independent of the expansion part of the Affordable Care Act was the no wrong door is the kind of term used, that when somebody would come in for services, maybe not for Medicaid, but for some other services, they would have this one application process for TANF or for some other type of service, and if they were eligible for Medicaid, they could have been signed up for Medicaid at that point. So it is, as well as the other component of you had to have insurance, so the insurance mandate. And so someone goes to the federal website to sign up, and it turns out that they're not going to get private insurance, they're eligible for Medicaid, and so logically they're going to go on Medicaid instead. And so there was a increase in traditional Medicaid for both children and other adults.
Okay. So. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, please continue.
Sure. This graph shows the difference of three different groups here between 2010 and 2019. So the green line is on a per capita price or per Medicaid enrollee basis, growth in spending. And so on a per enrollee basis, spending has been very flat in Medicaid. So it's grown by less than 1% per year of that period of time. For recipients, so Medicaid enrollees who are actually using services, so a smaller denominator, that's the spending per Medicaid recipient has increased by 1.5% per year. And then finally, the blue line is everyone essentially on private insurance, it's for everybody in Alaska overall, so it's all the public insurance, all the private insurance stuff together, has increased by 4.7% annually. And if you're on insurance through your work or others, you know you've experienced these 10%, 15%, 8% and stuff jumps at different years over since 2010. And so in Alaska, that across everybody, that average out to about 4.7% per year. So the takeaway to me on this is that that the Medicaid program overall has done a pretty good job of controlling growth, so that the spending growth. And so as a lot more people are on the program, the growth in spending on a per individual basis has not been very high. I'm not sure why these end up with shadows there instead of a nice pretty color, but this graph shows the bars are state gross domestic product or gross state product for Alaska in nominal terms, 2010 through 2019, and the blue line is the healthcare expenditures as a proportion of the GDP. So what percent of GDP is made up by healthcare? And so the recession in Alaska started late 2014, early 2015. And so as the bar shows, you have a steep decline for a couple of years in GDP that's been growing out of there. At the same time, the proportion of the economy made that healthcare is has increased from 15% before 2016 to nearly 20% today. And so what happened? Well, the economy got smaller, but healthcare didn't. And so it's a, just becomes a larger proportion right there. In addition, Medicaid expansion and other components of the Affordable Care Act have driven up demand for healthcare services. So today, the healthcare as a percentage of the population, or excuse me, healthcare as a percent of the economy in Alaska is nearly 20%, which is about the same amount, same level as U.S. overall. And then finally, in this section, this figure shows the red line is medical price inflation for Alaska, so for the Anchorage metro area. The orange dashed line is the same series, but for the U.S. overall. And the takeaway here, and this is the reason I went all the way back to 1984, is to show that these two series have been together for most years, and then late in, let's say, 2009, 2010, they started to diverge quite a bit. And so that medical prices in Alaska are growing much faster than they are in the U.S. as a whole. And then the bottom two, the dark blue line and then the lighter blue dashed line, the dark blue is Alaska CPI, so the whole basket of goods purchased by consumers. And the blue dashes are the U.S. And so over the same period of time, the growth in prices for all products and services consumed by Alaskans has grown a little bit slower than the U.S. overall. So, and the reason added this in here is to show that the steep increase, the relatively high increase in prices, in medical prices in Alaska relative to the U.S. overall isn't explained by just a higher growth rates in the CPI in Alaska, because it's not. It's actually a little bit lower growth rate. Instead, there's other factors at work here that are driving up prices that are already higher than anywhere else in the U.S., as you well know. So the CPI, and again, this graph is not showing that your medical prices or healthcare prices are more expensive than the rest of the U.S. They're showing that your rate of change in healthcare prices are increasing faster.
So I had a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. I wanted to just ask you really quickly about the healthcare price inflation that you've brought forward here. In previous committee work in Hess, you know, we had great conversations in the sense of talking to different hospital providers and physicians and trying to figure out how we can lower those costs, and part of it was just competition among various physicians and healthcare facilities. Not that they're kind of out competing each other, but you know, if Dr. Brown is charging $5,000 for a certain x-ray or procedure, well, Dr. Smith over here is going to charge $100 more, and it's almost like they're setting rates as they want to and as they can without any structure to kind of put the pressure on to bring it down. So I guess my question is, how do you fight that? How do you delve into that to try to truly bring down those costs?
Right. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I think you're exactly right in the sense that what you're saying is that Dr. Brown and Dr. Smith have a lot of market power. In Alaska, and that's true. The U.S. and Alaska medical price inflation is something to look at periodically, and I haven't looked at it for a few years because they always track the same. It's like, oh yeah, a little higher this year, a little lower this year, whatever it might be. And so it's been a few years since I've looked at that, and I had expected to see any deviations that just kind of come back. So I was surprised when I saw this, and my immediate, as an economist, as a statistician, my first thought was, it's a small data series, and so it's maybe noisy data. But that's not the case. This is too consistent of a series divergence right here. And so as an economist, very quickly, my assumption is that this is, and I had not something I've researched, but my assumption is that this is an instance where you have a small market, relatively small market, and that's spatially isolated. You can't just drive to San Francisco if you don't like the prices here. And you have a marketplace that has consolidated a lot in the past decade. And last week I talked to a friend of mine who's at Oregon Health, is an economist at Oregon Health and Sciences University, and just went over with him. And unfortunately, just to bounce some thoughts off of him, and we were kind of on the same line, that this is a case where you have your doctors, maybe your hospitals, maybe your providers, they're price setting because they can. And you can't, again, it isn't that you're going to be able to drive from one side of Puget Sound to the other side of Puget Sound to go to a different doctor, a different provider. And then the other side of this is that you would have in a Seattle market and a lot of other markets in the lower 48 is you don't have that robust insurance marketplace. Insurance companies do not have much power here to negotiate lower prices. So that's, you know, without having actually done any analysis to look at what consolidation has happened over time, just at that high level, that's what it very much appears to be going on here. What do you do about it? You know, other states have begun this, have similar problems, not to this extreme, having to publish prices so that a clearinghouse of prices of what is being charged essentially open up that scrutiny is, you know, one option. My understanding is managed care is not permitted in Alaska. I don't know that managed care could work in Alaska, even in Anchorage. I don't know if it's a large enough market to really attract, that type of a system. I have not focused on the issues of what to do about this. And this is not, this picture is not a Medicaid issue right here. This is an Alaska healthcare issue. And it also should be clear that these rates are private insurance. So this is not capturing Medicaid spending on here. This is issues of private spending. However, Medicaid does not exist in a vacuum. Medicaid prices in Alaska are going to track along with. It might be lower, certainly lower, but they're going to be the demands of providers for the increase over time are going to follow with what they're doing to other prices. So let's get the projections. So to start with that first step, population. Population was very rapid in Alaska decades ago and has slowed quite a bit, just like in much other parts of the U.S. So the last few years has been slightly negative growth rate. Expectations from Department of Labor and Workforce Development is that that isn't a permanent phenomenon, that Alaska will continue to start growing again slowly at about 0.5% per year through the next 20 years. And so so that's the basis. This is the population that could be, you know, on Medicaid in the future. So that's our first step. That population has changed and will continue to change. And so, as it's growing by 0.5% a year, the growth rate of those 65 and older is going to grow by more than 1.5% per year. Working age adults, or traditional working age adults, growing much slower, and children even a little slower than that. So it's the population is changing. It's changing everywhere in the U.S. It's a little more dramatic right now in Alaska. And then switching over to enrollment, and I'm just going to sent you two lines here, so that 2015 to 2020, so the fiscal year before Medicaid expansion to the current fiscal year, and overall 9% growth rate, 9% per year growth rate in enrollment. Going forward, it's going to be a lot slower, 1%, slightly over 1%, and faster with seniors than with children and working age adults in the future. All the changes that have happened to Medicaid over the last 15 years and then continued into the next 20 years is really, I think, is interesting in that today Medicaid covers many more adults than it does children. And that even when I started with this 15 years ago, that was definitely not the case. And in 2000, the median age, so half of Medicaid was 14 or younger, and half was over 14. Today it's 23. So half of Medicaid enrollees are 23 or younger, the other half are older than that. And it's going to creep up to 25 by 2040. And so that's a very different program than what it looked like 20 years ago. And this picture just gives that very long view from the as early a day as I have access to, from fiscal year 1997 out through 2040, with the black line representing essentially fiscal year 2019. You can see it's been growing this whole time, very rapid growth over the last 4 or 5 years in the working age adult population. So that's Medicaid expansion largely right there. And again, growth will slow, but will likely continue over the next 20 years. Spending, and we expect spending to continue to slow also, and I know this graph doesn't show it because everything to the right of that black line gets really big compared to the left, but this is the power of compounding interest right here, compounding growth rates. And so going back to 2000 and such was a program well below $1 billion, and we're at, you know, well over $2 billion today and pushing above $5.5 billion in 20 years. And this is based on this, what the population and the demographics look like, how enrollments will likely continue to play out, and then most of all, the issues of medical price inflation. So.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Just a quick question, if I could, please. So when you refer to seniors, you've got the age, of course, 65 and older. So the correlation in that is also with Medicare dollars, is that correct? Or are you just highlighting Medicaid only?
Yes.
But for recipients for Medicare, age 65 and older, why are they on Medicaid and not just Medicare?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, great question. So this is Medicaid only. And so so those 65 and older, many or all are dual eligible, eligible for Medicaid and for Medicare. And I don't know the ins and outs of all the policy associated with this, but so many of those 65 and older are going to be on Medicare also. And often their premiums are paid by the Medicaid program, because Medicare would then be the first payer on those services. But this is showing only those Medicaid dollars. So, yeah.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this graph that scarily goes up to over $5 billion in 20 years, how much of that is it looks like, compared to your graph on the price increase, which you mentioned, is this largely due to that graph as opposed to, say, population growth?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Wool. Great question and great segue. So we have a graph that shows that in about three more slides. Okay. We'll get that, what this part.
Follow-up?
Okay, I'll hold my breath for that answer. The other question is, the median age obviously has gone up since expansion allows young adults that without kids and allows men and so on and so forth. Are you taking into account that, and I'm sure you are,
that some of those people who are eligible when they're 21, maybe when they're 31, don't need it anymore and come off Medicaid. So not like once you're on, you're always on.
Through the chair, Representative Wall, that's exactly right. And so in the forecast, so that's an important point. It isn't the case, definitely not the case, that we are assuming that is just cumulative adding people in. In the forecasting, on that step, on the enrollment part of the forecast, it's a set of statistical models that looks at for there's 240 different subgroups, so based on 12 age cohorts, gender, male, female, as well as Alaska Native status, and that's in there because of the 100% FMAP associated with for Alaska Natives who receive services at the appropriate clinics, as well as then five regions. So 12 times 2 times 2 times 5, 240 different subgroups. And so the models look at the probability that an individual will enroll in Medicaid in each of those years going forward, based on historical data, largely based on historical data and trends. So, yeah.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Johnston. On the other side of Colleen Sullivan-Leonard's question about the older folks, what about younger people? I'm not very familiar with Denali Kid Care, but is that part of this program?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Merrick, yes. So Denali Kid Care. So Medicaid is nothing if not complicated, so for sure. And so while I often will say, we need to be very, very concise on what we're talking about, so Title 21 Kids is not technically Medicaid, but I always include it. It's included here as part of Medicaid. So all children on that are truly on Medicaid or on CHIP are included here. So yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And they'd be enrolled through different eligibility categories. So this graph shows the average spending per Medicaid recipient. Per enrollee in this case, so average spending per enrollee in Medicaid. So for children, adults, working age adults, so 20-64, and seniors 65 plus in 2020, and then each 5 years to 2040. No surprise that seniors on average are more spending on seniors than for working age adults and children, and that's going to continue into the future. And so now switching gears a little bit, still with spending, but looking at the portion that's federal spending versus general fund spending, in 2020, based on those forecasts, estimating just under $670 million in general fund spending versus almost $1.6 billion for the feds, and then growing at about the same rate through 2040. And I probably should have mentioned earlier, for this long-term forecast, everything we're doing is based on claims from the data service, so not the data payment. So if the data service was in fiscal year 2019, but it was paid in 2020, we assume we're focused on 2019. We're on when the claim happened, when that enrollee received the services, which is different than for budgeting purposes when you care about data payment. So over the long run, they're going to be the same. But year to year, they're going to be different. So this should not be confused with estimate of what the department would spend this year per se. It should be close, but it's not going to be the same because this is focused on that 2020 is received the services in fiscal year 2020. Then one other note here that there's no assumption of no changes in FMAPs, so that into the future. So we end up at this point now that about equal rates of growth for federal spending and state spending assumed for the future.
Excuse me, could we go back to mm-hmm. So I was trying to look to see what story is being told here. With Medicaid expansion, you do have a step down as far as the federal reimbursement. Mm-hmm. But even with that step down of federal reimbursement, the growth in federal spending is about equivalent, very close to the growth in state spending. Is that what you're saying here?
Madam Chair, that's right. And so great question, because this is fiscal year 2020, so half of that, that first half of that is with the FMAP for the expansion population of 93%. The second half is at 90%. So even with that step down over that period of time in the base year, it's going to end in 90% every year after that. The state has realized the last few years savings through the rebasing, so a lot of the IHS services and such, which will continue to diminish. So, once they're done in a sense. And so even with the step down from expansion, we end up at about the same growth rate for the two.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Can you tell me how the FMAP is calculated and how Alaska compares to other states?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick. Sort of. So again, back to that, it's nothing if not complicated. So there are many different FMAP rates. So and again, I'm using language a little bit sloppy right here. So the traditionally FMAP has been the Title 19 program FMAP, basic or regular FMAP, which is 50% for Alaska. And that is, there may be some other alchemy in it, but it's largely based on personal income. And so Alaska, even though it's a high cost state, it's also a high personal income state. And so ends up being having a low FMAP rate of 50%. So the lowest FMAP is 50%. And then can tier up from there, and I'm not sure, up to 65% or so. So that's the basic FMAP.
Follow up.
I would just be interested to see, a list of the states and what their percentages are, just for a comparison. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. So, Representative Johnson, to your question about the growth rates, what portion of this is population change? How much of it's enrollment and such? This is what this graph is showing. So, the blue horizontal band at the bottom is spending today, and so that blue band essentially says, okay, let's assume that you keep this same Medicaid population stays and never gets older, and you just have it for the next 20 years. That's what your spending is going to be. So, not realistic. And then we're just going to grow off of there. So that very light sand colored or gray band is population growth. So there's going to be slow population growth that's going to lead to more enrollment in Medicaid, and so that's represented right there. On top of that is enrollment growth above population. So expectation is enrollment growth is going to, so the proportion of the population enrolled is going to increase slightly over time. And so that gets us up to the green band. And then the utilization of Medicaid services is the dark brown. Again, utilization of Medicaid services is that we have 20 of all the services offered by Medicaid. Those are aggregated into 20 different service categories, and then just as there's over time, individuals enrolled in Medicaid are using more and more of those different services. So someone who is using outpatient hospital and X-ray services is now also using personal care or whatever it might be. And so that's has grown historically, and will continue to grow. And so that's that little extra increment was right there. The brown is the impact of utilization of Medicaid services. The light blue is intensity of Medicaid services. Individuals that had been using outpatient hospital in different years, 10 years ago when they went into outpatient hospital and their knee hurt, they got an x-ray. Next year when they go in, they get an MRI instead. And so there's that intensity of services due to technology or to changes in care provided happens over time. And so so that increases costs over time, but it's not very much. And that's represented by that light blue band. And then finally, the top one, the mauve-colored, is healthcare price inflation. That's what that's
Zen type.
So that's the elephant in the room, whatever metaphor you want to use. That's what's really going to drive costs in the future. And as we showed earlier, medical price inflation is high everywhere in the U.S. It's higher in Alaska than the rest of the U.S. And and it may I realize that prices paid to providers are contracted, but those providers want to contract for higher prices all the time, and they're basing what they want to get, what they want those to increase by what they're getting in the private marketplace. And so the assumption is that the medical price inflation that we've been seeing in Alaska, I don't think it's going to continue as high as it has. I don't think it can, but it's still going to be the largest driver of costs in the future. So,
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. So if I understand what you're saying correctly here is that we've got a kind of an economy of scale problem. Not enough sick people for the amount of doctors that we have to continue increasing doctors and healthcare facilities and people that want to see a growing budget every year, a growing bottom line. This is not enough people getting sick. One way to look at it.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter.
Too small a population.
I don't think that'd be the case because Alaska's always had a small population, other states have a small population without having the increases in prices that are as great as increases in healthcare prices as you're seeing in Alaska. In addition, you have a small population when it comes to purchasing energy and food and all these other goods and services, yet the CPI, the overall CPI, is growing slightly slower in Alaska than the rest of the U.S. And so, again, what I see is one sector of the economy, the healthcare sector, that has a lot of market power that people can't shop around. It's let's be honest, it's opaque anyway. It's opaque in the best of in the most transparent part of the U.S. It's a pretty opaque market. Prices aren't listed when you walk in the emergency room. You don't know if your anesthesiologist is in network, yes, thank you. In network or not, you find out that surprise comes to you a month later and such. So, so this is this that's the scale issues. The scale issues are not driving growth in prices. The scale issues are definitely have an impact on the price you're paying relative to the rest of the U.S., but they're not driving prices up faster. That's something else that's going on. And again, as an economist, what I see is market power on the part of providers. And again, this is without, be clear, this is without studying those providers. But, that would be the first thing that my assumption would be. So.
Thank you. How would you or have you broken down the price inflation to show how competition in the lower 48, for example, between states, between metropolitan areas, for example, would impact prices down there compared to here? We see an increase in a severe increase in health care inflation in Alaska,
and we know that there's a lack of competition in multiple areas in the mm-hmm. in the industry. So how do you delineate in that inflation piece what how much of that is due to our remoteness and our lack of competition, meaning the population is small enough that we're never going to have additional competition in the sense that there's additional people flying to Alaska for healthcare, where we see the opposite happening, where Alaskans fly out of state for healthcare. So the competition for Alaska exists outside the state, but that's a small number. If that number was larger, we would have a greater competition number.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the most immediate would be to instead of using a projection of medical price inflation for Alaska, rather to take that and then to estimate medical price inflation, a forecast of that for the U.S. overall, compare it to this and see how much lower it would be. That difference would be that that Alaska premium, I guess. So the flying people out of Alaska for services that they could receive here, my guess is that's more of a reaction to the price setting behavior of providers here. So and going back to that that graph on medical price inflation for Alaska versus the U.S., this hasn't always been there. It used to be the problem with medical price inflation that is in the lower 48 looked like about the same as it is in Alaska. It looked pretty much the same, and then it delineated in 2009, 2010, wherever, and has continued to grow since then. So I guess I would, there's a number of things you could do. You could look at service by service by service, what are they charging in Anchorage versus, several other places, and acknowledge that it's Alaska, so there's some reasons why it could be more expensive. But if something is 10 times more expensive in Alaska than it is in Seattle or San Francisco, Seattle's more expensive to live in than Alaska, I think, and I know San Francisco is. So there's limits to the expectation for an Alaska premium. So
follow up. Just to kind of round that out, yes, there are other places that are more expensive, but those places also have larger populations. So the economy of scale problem is that, yeah, it's more expensive, but there's more people needing health care.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that would impact the cost today, not the change in costs over time. So that should not drive costs to grow faster. It may result in costs being higher, but the change over time should be no different. And so that's the difference in CPI. It isn't that costs are higher. It isn't showing that costs in Alaska are higher than costs in the lower 48. It's showing that the growth in costs are higher in Alaska than in the lower 48. That's all it's showing. And again, when you look at the overall CPI, costs have grown at a slower rate in Alaska with a smaller population. So it's other sectors of the economy, they're still servicing that smaller population also, yet they don't have that same rate in price growth. So,
do you one last follow up? Mm-hmm. Do you have a graph that shows when federal dollars increased into, and maybe we already looked at it, and I need to go back and review this, but when did the federal dollar increase into the healthcare industry? What is the trend over the same time period? Meaning, as federal dollars come into the healthcare industry, now we see a growth in services because we've got that driving factor. There's an expectation that money's coming in.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that's happens all through the U.S. also, though. And so, in those that, federal dollars have flow into healthcare everywhere. Every state has a Medicaid program. Every state has individual on Medicare. The expansion happened in certain states well before it did in Alaska. One or two states have Montana is one that expanded at approximately the same time as Alaska. So and as well as those dollars, those are federal dollars, not included, which are not included in the CPI, measure of the CPI. That's private dollars only. So, but the Medicaid program is going to be the growth or the push for increased spending or increased rates by providers is going to be influenced by that medical price inflation.
So you're certainly not suggesting that Alaska has a higher percentage of greedy people than elsewhere, that we suffer from some sort of healthcare greed in this state more so than other states. We just jack up our prices higher because we can.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I look at this as an economist. I look at this and I see market power, and I don't see does nothing to do with greed or anything else. I see market power, and I look at this in instance of, and I'm not looking at again the difference in prices. I'm looking at difference in the change in prices, and in a place like Anchorage, that is relatively small metro area compared to many other places throughout the U.S. that's spatially isolated. Healthcare providers have consolidated throughout the U.S. I look at this and I certainly see what looks like providers setting prices as opposed to taking prices. Providers that may not have a strong insurance network to push back against them. So, as I mentioned earlier also, this is not something I've studied per se. I've not been asked to study that by the commissioner or other staff. The healthcare price inflation is what is driving costs, is a big driver of costs here, and so it's an important thing to have in here, and it's something that that is beyond Medicaid. It's a statewide issue, and as well as when we looked at that graph earlier of 10 years ago, healthcare was 14% of the Alaskan economy. It's 20%. Part of that is because other parts of the Alaskan economy has shrunk, oil. But there's also other issues. There's other components also. Medicaid expansion could be part of that. Issues of cost.
And a follow-up to that, Representative Carpenter, to have a further understanding, you might go to one of the ISER reports as far as out-of-network cost and what that has done to the cost of healthcare in Alaska. It could give you a broader base of this. I'm sorry to jump in the queue here, but this is in relation to all this discussion. I realize this is a point in time, mm-hmm. and as far as medical cost, have you looked at just the state's experience right now, our employee cost and our retirement costs in medical cost has dropped precipitously. Have you built that into this model?
Madam Chair, I have not. So of actual state employees and stuff.
It's state employees and our retirement community. We had a unfunded liability in our pension funds that was very large from medical cost, mm-hmm. and that has dropped a great deal. And I think you'll find also that there's a couple of other public insurance programs, self-insurance programs, that have dropped some medical costs just for a point in time. Right. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To what extent did you consider or evaluate the 80th percentile rule that we use in Alaska? And if you want to explain it, probably better.
Yeah.
Did you already go over that when I was out of the room? No.
No. Through the chair, Representative Wool. again, dealing with Medicaid, I don't deal with that. Yeah, on that. So so that does not come into the forecast anywhere. Okay. So yeah.
But follow up. Uh-huh. Just you're talking about Alaska prices.
Yeah.
And market power, so on and so forth, and the reimbursement rate, which I guess doesn't really apply to Medicaid
directly,
but it applies to private insurers, so therefore Medicaid, as you said earlier, kind of parallels that to some degree. So I didn't know if that maybe could explain. I know it's sort of a hot topic sometimes, but I didn't know if you analyze that at all. But.
And Representative Wall, that was what I was suggesting to Representative Carpenter, that he might want to review the ICER study. Okay. Representative Knopp, did you still have a question?
No.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, I'm following up on Representative Wall's question. There would be a connection, wouldn't there, if, for example, if the private sector healthcare provider had exorbitant rates or costly medical providers, we in the legislature may feel compelled to offer rate adjustment and inflation adjustment to sort of keep up for concern of diminishing the interest in Medicaid provision. So there would be some connection there.
Through the chair, Representative Jefferson, absolutely. And so while Medicaid rates are negotiated every year, every 2 years, every 3 years, whoever it might be, and they may go down at times, overall they go up. And the rate that they go up is going to be tied to medical price inflation. That's why it is a integral part of the forecast. And so, if medical price inflation is really low, then your prices are not, Medicaid prices are not going to increase very rapidly. And likewise, the providers how they negotiate. I don't know why. For one payer, prices would rise very quickly, and for others, they would be flat or decreasing or only increase marginally. That doesn't seem logical. So yes, absolutely, our assumption throughout is that prices paid for Medicaid services are going to roughly parallel the increases in all healthcare prices. So, absolutely.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The relationship between state-paid Medicaid and federal-paid Medicaid in this chart assumes that relationship doesn't change over time and that the state's portion and the federal portion is unchanged even under a growth scenario. It's relationship neutral.
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, the only place that it would change here would be with respect to the individuals being enrolled in Medicaid. So the forecast overall, let's assume that we know that the 65 and over population in Medicaid is growing faster than the 20 to 64, the working age population, and so. Those 65 and older, for the most part, are going to have an FMAP of 50%. No one 65 and older is going to be part of the Medicaid expansion population, and so the state will not receive a 90% FMAP for them. They'll receive a 50% FMAP in general, and so the forecast accounts for those adjustments in rates associated with an individual's age and the likelihood of what their eligibility category is going to be.
So on a follow-up, so with an aging population, you can expect the state share to grow with the aging population?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, yes, for sure, all else being equal, yes. So, at the same time, there have been the rebasing and the compared to a forecast from a few years ago when many Alaskan Native enrollees, beneficiaries of Medicaid, somewhere 65% of the services they received would get the 100% match from the federal government. Now it's 10 percentage points, 12, 14 percentage points higher than that, and so they're getting the 100%. And so the state is still benefiting. It's mostly working itself out at this point, but is still the forecast is still acknowledging that benefit of that, of the shifting of a lot of the spending to the feds. So,
one last follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember the debate back in 2015 to take on the expansion, mm-hmm. and part of the debate I heard was, well, the federal piece is going to pick up the majority of the expanded cost for the benefit. Can we expect as a state that that relationship is going to be consistent, that this is not some form of a get the state into the expansion, and then someday you'll see that relationship change in a material way? We should not anticipate that?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, so far beyond my pay grade. So the forecast is assuming no change in the structure, but you know, that's unanswerable. Yeah, unanswerable question. So.
Representative Josephson?
Oh, just that relative to that question, when the House was late in organizing, you may have read about that in the Seattle paper or somewhere, but there was a presentation by Becky Holtberg of ASHNA, our Alaska State Hospital Nursing mm-hmm. Association, and quite credible, respected person who's since left Alaska, but she made a strong case that the state comes out ahead. And I don't remember all the variables, there were four or five of them, but that even as we pay up to a 10% match, that there are all these imputed, what's the term? Essentially, there are benefits that come to the state for the fact that we're not getting a 50% match or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen those sorts of numbers before.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So, so essentially, I imagine Becky's point was that people are covered. They're not going to hospitals and get in with uncompensated care claims, and the federal government's paying 9 cents on the dollar, and so there's hundreds of millions more dollars flowing into Alaska every year that cycles through the economy, and so. Absolutely, with that view of economic view, certainly there's benefits to Alaska, and it's probably, the case, that I'm agnostic about expansion, but since expansion is part of ACA, and so Alaskans are paying taxes to support it, there is a logical, very logical argument for doing it, and I understand both sides of the argument like that. But there's certainly benefits to Alaska from doing expansion for sure. So, yeah. All right. So next few slides, taking a look back to the original forecast compared to the current forecast, and then what has happened, and so. So for each of these slides, there's going to be the red bar is what's actually happened. The blue dots are what was predicted back in the 2006 forecast, and then the green dashes are this forecast. And so in the 2006 forecast presented to the legislature, we predicted that given how the program was constructed at the time and how spending was moving, that there was going to be extremely rapid growth in Medicaid spending over the next 20 years, so up through 2025. And then the red in here shows what has happened since then. And so immediately the legislature and the department made some changes in personal care attendant services and other parts of the Medicaid program, and flattened spending growth for a few years, which started growing a little bit more after that. And then as we move into 2015, 2016, we had the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, so prices started, our spending started growing some more. But that red line indicates that bending of the cost curve from where the expectations of where prices were going to go. And the green just kind of continues with that, with what has actually happened. So that's total spending right there. So at the same time, the number of people receiving services through Medicaid is much greater today than we predicted in 2005 because of the Affordable Care Act. And so, as you can see in this one, that the actual number of recipients tracked very closely with the forecast until Medicaid expansion, in which time it grew quite a bit. And so today there's many more people enrolled, but also receiving services in Medicaid than we predicted due to expansion. So last graph showed spending is much lower than we expected. This graph is showing that many more people are receiving services than we expected. And so when we look at spending per recipient, it is much lower than we had forecast. And so, again, the red line being what's actually happened immediately following the that first forecast, spending per recipient decreased for a couple of years and pretty much has been relatively flat, and has been flat until 2020, and we expect it to increase over time, to start growing a little bit more. But this is, a series of graphs that just shows that the department, the legislature and the department together have accomplished quite a bit in actually slowing the growth in Medicaid program, and even while the Medicaid program has grown quite a bit.
Representative Walsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you just answered it, and that it's within the department they did some stuff. But you originally predicted fewer people covered at a much higher cost, and now you're getting lower costs for more people. And that's how is that accomplished? Or maybe why did you predict it would cost more to cover fewer people?
Right. Through the chair, Representative Wool. So, number one, we did not the forecast on the number of people covered, of course, did not include any expectation of expansion in the future. And so coverage-wise, roughly, in the forecast was in line with what actually happened until expansion. On the spending side, the total spending side, the impact here is that. A combination of the population projections at that time, this is one piece of it, was a greater rate of growth in the elderly population in Alaska at that point, which has grown faster, but not nearly at the rate as expected. In addition, where one thing we got wrong on that part was that, and so that forecast was the state's population, state's forecast. What we got wrong in conjunction with that is that we thought that those seniors that would be coming in, that would be either staying in the state or coming into the state, would look a lot like the ones that had been there before. But in fact, seniors today are wealthier, have higher income, they're wealthier, and are not eligible for Medicaid. So while the seniors are a growing part of the Medicaid program and faster than other components, they're still growing. Their rate of growth in Medicaid is a little slower than their actual population growth. So, so that spending growth has been impacted by we don't have nearly as many seniors receiving very expensive services as we had thought. And then the largest part of this has to do with deeper management or oversight of such programs services as a personal care attendant, ACB waiver and such, which were growing at 15 to 25% per year and now are growing at a couple percentage per year, or immediately following that, started growing at a few percent per year, much closer to other parts of the Medicaid program. And so so a lot of changes that went on with the department after that. So.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Johnston. Do Medicaid recipients pay any sort of copay or deductible?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, my understanding is not in Alaska. There's no copays, no deductibles. So, okay, so let's switch gears a little bit. The overall structure of this long-term forecast has been consistent each year, with a few changes and such that have made it better. One thing we added this year was, and we'll continue into the future, is to look at the issue of chronic conditions. So, and this is something the department looked more and more at with respect to cost drivers of Medicaid program. So chronic conditions. So there's a lot more in the report about chronic conditions and all the chronic conditions we looked at within the Medicaid population. So first of all, the good news is most people on Medicaid do not have a diagnosed chronic condition. And so this first graph shows in age grouping, so under 15, 15 to 24, 24 to 34 and on, the blue bar, the blue portion of the bar are Medicaid recipients who are not, do not have a diagnosed chronic condition, and the orange are recipients with a diagnosed chronic condition. And so, again, these are recipients, not enrollees. So this is just people who received Medicaid services in 2018. And so there's roughly 40,000 other individuals enrolled in Medicaid during that time who received no services. So these are just recipients. But you can see that over time with age, the proportion of individuals on Medicaid with a diagnosed chronic condition increases and is greater than those without a chronic condition, which of course demonstrates that chronic conditions are closely related to age. And so this graph just shows by age the proportion or the prevalence of chronic condition, of diagnosed chronic conditions in the Medicaid population with one or more chronic conditions. And so increasing over time. This table and next table violate the rule about how many numbers you put on one graph or one table or one slide, but this actually reads pretty easily. So five different columns, column A, B, C, D, E. Column A is just the 12 different age groups we focus on in doing the long-term forecast. Column B is the average spending in fiscal year 2018 for recipients of that age group. And when you look at this, the thing that jumps out, should jump out, is spending per recipient increases with age. And so that's which we're in tune to believing. And it shows it right there. Column C, though, shows the average spending per recipient for recipients who do not have a chronic condition. And except for the youngest and the oldest, there's really no difference in spending based on age. So when we exclude those without a chronic condition, there's not much change. Likewise, in column D is the average spending per recipient for those with a chronic condition, and the same phenomenon. There's not much difference except for the 85 and older. There's not much difference in spending for those with a chronic condition. Once we segment based on chronic condition or no chronic condition, age doesn't really play in. And so, even though we know that as we saw from the column B, that as you increase in age, the average spending per recipient increases quite a bit. And so the takeaway is that the number of, or the prevalence of chronic conditions increases with age. That's explaining why age has an effect on spending. as the chronic conditions. So finally, then, column E is simply what we refer to in the report as the incremental cost of chronic conditions. It's simply the average spending for a recipient with a chronic condition minus the average spending for a recipient without a chronic condition. So how much more does a person with a chronic condition, a Medicaid recipient with a chronic condition, cost? And so on average, it's about $21,000 more per year in fiscal year 2018 for those with a chronic condition.
Representative Carpenter. Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there, and I'm ignorant on this subject significantly, so help me. Is there a stratification within Medicaid payments, or what is a chargeable or allowable from the provider based on age? Meaning a younger person comes in and the doctor or provider is allowed to charge only so much, but if an older person comes in, they're allowed to charge more because it could be more complex or something. I don't know. I'm just curious if Medicaid has a stratification for age.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, not to my knowledge that there's anything age-based pricing, but I really don't know. So let's continue this. Just another table full of numbers. So column A is the same as the column A here is the same as the column A in the first table, and column E is the same. So the first and second columns of this table are the first and last column of the last table. So the age categories and the incremental costs in spending for recipients with a chronic condition. Now adding in column F is the number of recipients in 2018 with a diagnosed chronic condition, with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. And then finally in column G is just multiplying those two numbers together to get the total incremental cost to the Medicaid program associated with chronic conditions. And so in 2018, the spending based on data service was about $2.2 billion, and $1.3 billion of it, based on my definition, had to do with the incremental costs, the additional costs paid to treat recipients with a chronic condition. And so that's as you see, that's well over half of $2.2 billion. So it's a big issue in healthcare in the U.S. It's a big issue in the Medicaid program in Alaska, and likely a growing issue, especially as mentioned, we have an aging population. So finally, today, about 73% of Medicaid spending is on beneficiaries diagnosed with one or more chronic conditions. And I should note in here that Medicaid Management Information System, so where all the claims are stored or processed and such, the providers are supposed to, in most cases, provide a diagnosis code so that we can use to determine, for payment and such. And that's what we use to determine if it's a chronic condition or not. And some claims aren't required to have diagnosis codes. Pharmacy claims do not have to have diagnosis codes. A lot of other claims may just don't have them for some reason. This is based on what we see in the database of those diagnosed with a chronic condition. 73% of the spending is for beneficiaries with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. And simply based on the aging of the population, of the Medicaid population over the next 20 years, by 2040, that's going to be 78%. So about $4 out of every $5 is going to be for individuals with chronic conditions. So a very large and increasing issue within the Medicaid program. So.
Could you define chronic condition?
Sure. There's if you Google that question, Madam Chair, you'll find confusion with chronic condition. So a chronic condition is a medical condition that lasts three or more months. That's one definition. Is a chronic condition that lasts a long time is another one. A chronic condition, a medical condition that lasts a year or more. So there's ambiguity with that. For our purposes, for this forecast and for other work done with the department, we use the CMS, has the CMS called the chronic condition warehouse, where they define chronic conditions based on the what's known as the ICD-10, the ICD-10 diagnosis codes. And so it lists out the diagnosis codes that indicate an individual has a chronic condition. And so we for our purpose here, we define this based on the CMS diagnosis codes for chronic conditions.
So when we look at any population, there's always the cost driver, 6 or 7% of the population. And we probably would call most of that 6 or 7% in the realm of chronic conditions, correct? Even though it's end of life for the most part, or can be.
Through the chair, Chairwoman Johnson, yes, but it's even deeper than that. So and this is chronic conditions could be a person could have a chronic condition from birth, from cystic fibrosis, from any number like that. So you have those type of chronic conditions. You have chronic conditions that we widely regard as aging related, strokes. Falls can be very costly, heart disease and such. That could be both aging, could be lifestyle, and then there's also chronic conditions that it includes opioid addiction, other drug addiction, smoking, alcohol abuse. So there's chronic conditions that are very social oriented also, or choice oriented perhaps, along those. And and we see this in the database, and it's talked about in the literature quite a bit. It's not simply chronic conditions; it's those co-chronic conditions, obesity and diabetes, that go together. And so it's that first chronic condition. There's certain costs there, but the person then ends up with a second chronic condition, a third chronic condition that become expensive. And that relationship with aging: the longer you live, the greater chance you have to pick up a chronic condition or the next one. So
this story could change through some aspect of a managed care or as you say, a wellness coordinator or a health healthy lifestyle, that would make a huge impact on the cost of chronic conditions, or could.
Madam Chair, I would personally, that's not something I've studied here, but that's, that seems logical to me that could be the least expensive way to deal with the chronic conditions is not to get one at all. I mean, that seems logical. How practical and how the Medicaid program could implement such a thing, I don't know what that would look like. But
I guess another aspect of that is reaching a patient at a beginning of a condition or having medical access can actually decrease the cost of the chronic condition later on with a wellness approach versus a catastrophic approach.
Right. Madam Chair, work I was involved with the department and the Division of Public Health, and specifically looked at that with respect to diabetes, and in just using the academic literature, marrying to the Medicaid, the MMIS, Medicaid Management Information System for fiscal year 2017 or 2016, and it's suggested that there could be savings to the program associated with diabetes self-management there. So so those seem to be logical, But the ease of implementation and such, that's...
That was in the details,
yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you say again the resource for chronic conditions that you listed?
Sure. It was a report done for Division of Public Health, it was posted to the department's website, I believe, in December of this last year, December 2018, I could also dig it up and send it to you.
It would be good to have a better understanding of what those chronic conditions are.
Sure.
I suspect that if we had different lifestyle choices, and we wouldn't have these problems, right? I mean, that's oversimplification of the problem. If we were healthier, we would not have healthcare problems.
Yeah, through the chair, for some respects, sir, yeah.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Johnston. We talked about medical coverage for Medicaid recipients. Do they also receive dental, vision, and prescription coverage?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick. Yes, there's pharmaceutical services, and I don't know the limits on those. I can't, but there's also vision care that, at least for children, and then there's dental within the healthcare services, as well as the adult dental program. So that's a preventative type of, yeah.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would cancer be considered a chronic illness?
Through the chair, indeed, yes. Representative Wall.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
Exactly, yeah. And that would be part of this is, and that's what I think is important, and we, earlier conversation had with folks in the department is that this is the first time we've had this in the forecast, looking at the chronic conditions, and we use the essentially the census of chronic conditions as published by CMS, but what really we should have in there is a categorization of those chronic conditions into prenatal and like that, so that because it's they are very different. A stroke is a very different than a stroke, especially for a very elderly person, is a very different chronic condition than smoking, which is very different than cystic fibrosis and stuff. And so there's that many of these are they're not preventable per se. But they're a chronic condition. They're with the person. So.
Any other questions? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, am I right that one of the drivers of care for the elderly in the Medicaid program is it sort of covers long-term disability, and the cost, if someone had the wherewithal and the wisdom in their 30s or 40s or even older, to purchase it, it's just incredibly expensive. So they punt and they rely on Medicaid. That's got to be a big factor, I would think.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, all I can do is speculate. And you're right. Long-term care is not only expensive; it's unlike a life insurance policy, the rates may go up later. So you don't know what you're buying may not exist when you need it. So, my wife and I have looked into many times into that and not done it because what's that policy going to look like when we hit 65? Can we afford, is the rates going to be three times higher than we're paying right now? So it doesn't work like a standard life insurance policy. Logically speaking, I think people would, their inclination would be to not purchase, often not purchase it, and rely later on the state. So.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the chronic care discussion. And obviously, you said it's going up because the population is aging, and I guess I wanted to mention cancer because some things aren't necessarily preventable, but other lifestyle choices were made as far as, you know, smoking and drinking and certainly things like obesity and diabetes, which are linked, are chronic care type conditions. But so the chairwoman mentioned, well, maybe there'd be more wellness and people would start, you know, exercising more and decreasing some of these things. But at the same time, if you look back, I guess the trend is not towards that, if I'm not mistaken, as far as the population as a whole. We are not getting healthier. We're, in fact, getting less healthy lifestyle-wise. And is that factored in? And do you agree with that? Do you think the people over time have gotten more sedentary and maybe are increasing our chronic conditions irregardless of age?
Yeah, through the chair, President Wool. So the forecast is accounting for that growth in the rate of enrollment in the Medicaid program, which would be driven by a number of factors, including issues of chronic conditions that could lead to a person being disabled, so to that extent. With respect to the population getting less healthy, I think, again, this not something I've studied, but there's I've read enough articles in The Economist and New York Times, whatever it might be, that shows across the not just the Western world, the developed world, that obesity rates have only increased. And so it is, it's, I guess, pushing a rock up a hill is the analogy here, the metaphor. So a large rock probably up a hill.
Representative Carpenter.
That's exercise.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. So this may be a question outside of what you've studied as well, but you've certainly looked into this a whole lot more than I have. Is there a component of Medicaid that encourages personal responsibility with respect to contributing behaviors to developing chronic conditions and additional medical care that could be prevented if they made lifestyle choices? Is there some mechanism there that ties into personal responsibility?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I'm not aware of if there is or there's not, so I don't know. Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you. It was a great report, and thank you for presenting.
Great. Thank you.
I am going to, or you are going to, because I can't reach that. I am going to recess this meeting until tomorrow, February 19th at 10 a.m. At that meeting, we'll take up the University of Alaska Subcommittee closeout report.